The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
It's not that we know how to listen to people. It's that we like to listen to people. We like to listen to every single word and dissect. We just love to dissect things.
You are listening to Change Lab, conversations on transformation and creativity. I'm Lauren Buckman, president of Art Center College of Design.
Mari Nakano is a pioneering social impact designer at the forefront of her profession. She was recently named Deputy Director of the Service Design Studio for the New York City Mayor's Office for Economic Opportunity. Previously, she spent 4 years as the Design and Interaction Lead for UNICEF's Office of Innovation, with a focus on finding solutions for children around the world whose lives are in turmoil. Today, we trace Mari's journey from her childhood household of makers to her trailblazing career in the emerging field of social innovation, and we are treated to stories of her tireless work on behalf of at-risk populations near and far. Learn where she draws her inspiration and how she hopes to deploy her problem-solving tactics closer to home to address local issues facing underserved communities in New York City.
Okay, so I'm interested in a lot of issues, but along the way, it's really interesting and important to try to understand who you are as a human being, who you are as a person, and in that spirit, to look back to young Mari, to childhood Mari, with very kind of specific interest in, you know, who were you as a creative person as a very young kid? What was that about? What were the influences? How did you detect in yourself that there was a creative spirit that maybe you loved, or maybe you were curious about, or maybe you just wanted to play with a little bit? Who was that child?
Yeah. I grew up in San Francisco, and I think when I think about my childhood, I think about my backyard. We had this old pear tree, and I'd love to climb it all the time and just find a branch I could sit in, or find a corner of the fence just so I could just sit and just kind of be above things and look down and feel like I was, you know, somewhere safe or in the sky. I was always like that. And I also had a dad who was always very DIY around the house. He was a Japanese sushi chef. But he was always just somebody who was fixing and making things. So he'd cook in the day, or, you know, cook in the evening, but he'd also, you know, be fixing the door and fixing, you know, just fixing anything that kind of was off in the house all the time. And he'd teach me, you know, like I'd hang out. I'd just hang out and watch him. I just was really curious to watch him, like, fix the car. We had a ping pong table, and one of the ping pong balls was dented once. And I was like, oh, what do we do? How do you fix that? You know, and he goes, come here. And he just brings me over to the furnace, and he turns the hot water on into a bucket. And he goes, watch. And he throws a ping pong ball in there, and because of the heat, it popped back into shape. I was like, oh my gosh, that's fascinating. But how do you know? He just always knew how to solve problems. And I didn't know where he was, like, getting those answers, but he was my Google, I guess, my Google.com person. I would search through him. And I just grew up around a creative family. You know, I really consider my dad an artist. My mom was like a secret artist. She helped run the restaurant, but whenever it came down to helping me with, homework, especially like science and art projects, she would help me, you know, sketch things out beautifully. And I, she could sew, she would make like these Japanese dolls with intricate kimonos on them. And just the, just these things were around me all the time. And so my brother and I kind of.
So you were born into a world of skillful people, capable people who did things.
Yeah. My dad was very artistic in that sense, and he encouraged me to be artistic. And then my mother was always extremely, like, the cheerleader for me. She's like, you can do anything you want. But she was also very, you know, disciplining. And because of all that kind of combination of things, I was, and because I think I naturally also was a type of person to really put a lot of pressure on myself to excel, all of that combination of stuff, like, really just made me, I guess, who I am right now.
So circling back, just to make sure, it wasn't like the creative or artistic life or the fixing life or the skillful making kind of life was off into some corner or sectioned off somehow or compartmentalized. It was part of the world you, the air you breathed, really. Mm-hmm. Is that there for you today? Does that feel like you now in your work, that kind of integration and that kind of lack of blurred lines in terms of your creative life?
Absolutely. You know, I think that even though I might have a 9-to-5, I think as a creative, as someone, you know, as a designer, it doesn't stop. It's not 5:30, 6 o'clock p.m., you know, when, and you're like, I'm done. I'm done thinking. I'm done making. You get on the train and you think, well, what's next? You know, when I go home, what problems do I need to solve when I get home? And I think now that I have a 3-year-old daughter, I spend a lot of time trying to instill creativity into her life. And so I'm always trying to engage with her on that and also just kind of present, like, what did I learn? You know, how did I learn? And so I could, you know, become creative and make my own stories and narratives. So I just, when I go home, she's like, she's there for me to, like, do that with, you know?
Right. Can you look at raising a child as a designer? Do you approach, can you take, quote unquote, design thinking to child rearing?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Do you? How's it work?
I do. I think it's a lot about, I think design thinking and research and those kinds of things are a lot about asking questions in the right way. And I think children are really good at training. Actually, maybe there should be a class on design thinking with children and kind of how do you extrapolate information from a young child, you know? You have to communicate differently. I think I've learned a lot about how to ask her questions in a way that she can understand. I think if anything, it's maybe helped me in my career, you know, and taking that back to work. I guess my first real job really out of college was working as a youth services coordinator in Little Tokyo. So, you know, I got trained in that way to work with kids and to work in the community.
And the activism was a huge part of that
work
at that time.
Yeah. And to just really integrate that into everything I was doing, especially with kids. But that's kind of, I guess, where it segues was, you know, I was a youth service coordinator at a place called Little Tokyo Service Center Community Development Corporation in downtown Los Angeles. And, you know, I was doing a lot of work trying to coordinate their after-school program, the Saturday classes, or the Saturday kind of programs, and a lot of just sort of the family services that were happening in some of the housing that we were in charge of. But a lot of the kids would come up to me most of the time and say, Mari, I want to learn photography. I love graffiti and I want to know how to, like, I want to know what else to do with it. I don't know how to write a resume. I don't know what to wear for a job interview. How can you help me? You know, and then I started realizing that a lot of these things could use design, could use someone that had that sort of creative thinking to help them kind of solve those problems or just achieve something that they were seeking that they couldn't find. Their resources mm-hmm. weren't available mm-hmm. for them. So I started really reaching out to different artists that I had been connected to, like muralists and poets, and having them come in and really work with those kids. And then I saw myself as a bridge, but then I thought, well, could I do that myself? And so I made this choice to go back to school. I said, well, I want to study. I want to teach design to these kids. And so that's kind of at the moment, that was the moment I said, well, I guess, you know, I'm going to go to Art Center. And that's when I applied and kind of decided to depart from that for a little while.
And why for you the call for design? Why that particular way of going about it at that time, mm-hmm. from what you knew then?
Right. I think that then ties back to like my childhood and my life growing up. That was something that I felt was me, you know. There were moments I thought, well, maybe I should go to law school and, you know, be a civil rights attorney.
We've all been there, yeah.
Right? I thought about that, or I thought about going into like holistic medicine and starting a clinic. And I really thought about all these different angles. And at the end of the day, the kind of that creative space for me was something I felt like very natural in. And so I thought I can blend this and my love for, you know, my love for design and my desire to like really be someone that can move the social impact space. You know, I can blend those things together.
But I'm interested in how you think about the design imagination and design work as fundamentally connected to making change in the world. I'd love your reflections on what that means to you.
Yeah. You know, I guess I see so many objects and products, technologies, and these fast ideas out there these days. And I think, you know, we live in a fast-paced world and everybody's trying to solve problems and make these sort of exponential impacts, you know, and sell that too. But I think where I've found kind of my sort of happy space with creativity is before all of that. When especially at UNICEF where I'm working right now, when a problem comes to us, all the designers want to take a breath and take a step back and say, well, why do we need this? And who's it for? Are we talking to the people that we need to solve this problem for? And we just get really curious, you know, and I think creatives are just naturally one, really empathetic, but they're extremely detailed about and intricate about wanting to know why we should do things.
And what is it about the designer that can affect change or be able to have impact in a way that, say, a social worker necessarily couldn't, or not to, I mean, social workers are wonderful, mm-hmm. or another kind of activist involved in a certain kind of situation. And I mean, we can generalize about that, but I'm really interested in it for you, for
right.
Mari. What is it that you think is there that allows the designer to do something that nobody else can do?
I think we it's not that we know how to listen to people. It's that we like to listen to people. I think we like to listen to every single word and dissect, or we just love to dissect things. So they're really good at knowing what to include and exclude. They like to build, designers like to invent and build new doors.
So moving on, tell us about your work now with UNICEF and what it is to be the lead visual designer at the UNICEF Innovation Unit. So maybe a little bit about the Innovation Unit itself and then what the team you're leading and what your purpose is there.
Sure. So UNICEF Innovation Team has been around for less than a decade, and it's comprised of mostly 40 and under, a mix of people from all different types of disciplines, data scientists and engineers, developers, designers, folks in development, of course. We have an innovation fund. We also have a couple specialists who are really just trying to really just kind of push the boundaries of what UNICEF had to offer. I think the thing is, like, UNICEF's mission is, you know, to help vulnerable children around the world.
Right.
And they're experts, UNICEF's experts at how to handle that, how to do that. But in a day like today, where we've got all these new technologies, we're really looking at how can we pivot those new ideas, those new technologies and designs? How can we pivot those organizations and companies to really look at UNICEF and say, well, what can we do for children? You know, and instead of just having a drone that's gonna go and just, you know, take you, that you can buy, you know, on Amazon for really cheap and just, you know, take a lot of really cool angles of your wedding or something like that. We're saying, well, how might a drone be able to, you know, deliver blood samples, you know, within a matter of hours to get tested for HIV and AIDS for a newborn child? How might we be able to use that right after a landslide or an earthquake to really go and scan an environment to make sure that there's nobody that's, you know, that needs help? And how do we talk to those types of businesses and say, we need you, but we also need you to, like, really look at your own business model and talk about and understand that doing good is good business.
And do you know historically who had this idea, who had the vision to bring an innovation unit into a place like UNICEF?
I think there's a small handful of people that really tried to pull the innovation unit together. You know, one is Christopher Fabian, right, and Erica Kochi. They're the co-leads, co-founders, and Sharad Sapra, who, you know, we call him the grandfather of innovation. Those guys were probably really the pioneers for really putting in an innovation team and experiment and taking that risk.
Were they already there, or were they brought in to do it? You know,
they were already there, and they came from that sort of UNICEF development perspective first, I guess.
I see.
So they didn't come in as like innovators or, you know,
right, that some leader had this idea, we're going to bring in an innovation
right,
team.
They were already present. And uh-huh. that's
and
the
so
thing.
It grew organically.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I think also the thing is, you know, what we've realized too by having this unit is that there's a ton of other UNICEF colleagues out there who have amazing ideas. You know, they're trained in a development space or a more traditional type of background. And so what we're trying to do is also kind of carve out space for them to present their ideas. Using the Innovation Fund, for example, or just being, you know, purely networked into our country offices and say, hey, this is a space you can come and share your kind of off hour ideas. And let's see how we can integrate that back into UNICEF and the work that we do. These big, clunky organizations, sort of old school organizations, they don't have room for risk, you know, and so people are afraid there. And so we're really trying to kind of bring that mentality into an organization like this to say, let's try, let's see what we can do. And we promise we can do bigger and better things, you know, on top of the things that we're already doing for the world.
So I want to get to what you do there, but you've set it up so well. Give us a story of an example of what the Innovation Unit has done that is really, I mean, you were referencing drones, maybe that's one of them, but what's been done that without the Innovation Unit, we would never have, UNICEF would never have been able to do or have imagined?
I think I'll take this opportunity to say, you know, I'm not going to talk about products specifically because you can read that on the internet on our blog, but I would say that the innovation team has taken a risk, big risk, in that I think they really pioneered putting design into the organization and integrating it. You don't see where UNICEF Innovation is probably the first sort of UN team that's built in design and designers into their team. When a developer has a new idea, we can sit with them and help them visualize what they're trying to put out there in the world. Really, in that sense, we've become advocates in a lot of ways for other divisions to really start to have them start thinking about how they might be able to build design or a design team maybe into their division or...
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Okay, so now circling back to you. So what does the lead visual designer do, you? I'm interested in how you... How, you know, what you do, how you work, who you are as a leader in that group, what you set up for your team and the people you work with. What do you bring?
Oh, boy. I think there's a couple things, I guess. One is that I think we really somehow defaulted to us being a lot this sort of ad hoc HR.
That's interesting.
I think it's that it's sort of that people knowing thing that we that the creative people have on our team. We care so much about who comes on board and making sure that they have the answers to all their problems, you know, for their administrative issues. I've in a lot of ways become sort of one of the people that, you know, the rest of the team will come to for just advice or, you know, just to shoot some ideas off of, you know, and find some direction. But I think also because design plays a role in every project that we have, my job is a lot to really find synergies between the projects. Because, you know, we have different teams that may be siloed into a specific project, but because design is in all those things, and I'm basically managing 20 plus projects, big and small, at the same time, I really have to look at how do I streamline what's going on, you know, how do I source out the right designers to the right projects at the right time, and can I look at one project and say there's a lot of overlapping relationships with this particular project and this other one in another country, perhaps. So there's a lot of this sort of kind of phone operator thing going on where I'm really trying to connect all these different pieces and really try to strengthen or emphasize what we do so it's not redundant.
Have you paid particularly close attention to the space that you build for your team? Is it a space that echoes the creative kind of fascination with fixing that you had from the earliest days of your life? What is that space? What's that space like that you've created for the team?
We just really try to set up a more dynamic working environment, first off. That's really helped us ideate and share things quicker. I think also from a design perspective, we really are looking at, well, it's almost like a portfolio class in a way. We are really trying to set up the space in a way that if you have an idea, you can pin it on the wall for, you know, whatever it's worth. If it's just in an early stage or if it has something to do with a major project or maybe nothing to do with a project at all. The designers have been trained from the beginning to use post-its and just kind of put everything out there. We're comfortable with our vulnerability, you know, being vulnerable in our process. And so because the other team members who have not come maybe from a creative space, they see that from us and we've made it friendly for them, I suppose. You start seeing this kind of really weird creative osmosis happening. And so a lot of the other team members are now like using post-its and starting to put things out on whiteboards or pinning things up and, you know, opening up their brain and putting that out on the wall for us to just really share and talk and dialogue with each other. And so I've seen that happen in the last few years and it's just, it's really fun.
See, I find that kind of thing incredibly exciting. I mean, just the kind of physical space that you as a leader of that team have built for them to be able to thrive and be able to do the things that you want. That to me is so resonant and exciting. I'll share with you for a minute that I think a lot about that in terms of, as the president of college, in terms of curriculum, because we are so, as administrators and faculty, so passionate about wanting our students to know all these things. And what we do in that process is we make requirements. And requirements are a necessary part to a certain degree of any kind of education curriculum. And it comes from a great place in faculty. I don't mean that. But is it really the most creative way to work? As opposed to the concept that you've articulated, a greater open space. But when you overload it too much, then you begin or cubicle it too much or requirement it too much, you start countering the very kind of creativity and open spirit and learning that you're trying to learn. So it becomes an interesting design problem to think about a curriculum, ironically, right? Mm-hmm. That lets the breeze blow through it a little bit, where there's a confidence that there will be discoveries. There will be moments of finding the sacred and the mundane that we'll put a post up on, that students will find that doesn't always have to be governed and structured in that way. Does that resonate with how you, how you work?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of being a creative, is being okay not knowing also, you know, and when, you know, we're kind of in this day and age where everybody's always asking you to know everything. And that's, you know, technology's always like, you know, you have to Google everything so you just know, so you can be like, I know this, I know this statistic, I read this, you know. And I think it's, we're doing less of saying, I actually don't know, could you teach me, you know. And when we're able to ask those type of vulnerable questions, that's when the experts can come and say, I need to, actually, I'm going to explain myself and what I know a little bit differently so the everyday person can better understand what I'm doing. And I think we need that space, right? In Japan, there's this thing called ma, which is space, which means space and silence. And that is just as important in any structure or narrative space as there is chaos and sound.
Absolutely, absolutely. And at some other point, you and I should talk about this in terms of how we educate people, because I think it's very, very meaningful. So you made reference earlier to the Innovation Fund at UNICEF. And I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about it. What is it? Why a VC model for what needs to be done? And are there, you know, ways in which your stories that you can tell us about that project that you think are important for us to know?
Why we chose a VC model was because I think a few things. Was one, you know, we really understood that there were people in the tech space, both in private and within the NGO type of space, who had great ideas, but not aware that maybe those ideas actually could work in a UNICEF type of mission-driven space. And so a lot of the folks that we're investing in, they have pretty rigid requirements when they do apply. You know, it can't just be, oh, what's your cool app that you're doing. All the products that are being invested in, they have to follow the principles of innovation. You know, does this product do no harm? Are you designing with the user? You know, a lot of these sort of design principles, right? And so we have to really put them through that rigor and say, are you following these types of things? And then really see the potential of what they're doing and work really closely with a lot of these companies to really build up their product in a way that is a really actual do-good product at the end of the day. And so we're actually really experimenting, I think, in a lot of ways with the fund.
Is there worry at all between the profit motive associated with the for-profit with a business versus working with an NGO or other nonprofits, where, you know, the goals and mission is very different?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question that a lot of these companies have, is like, how much am I going to make off of this, you know? And I think we're really pushing that. Well, there's a whole business in doing good, and you might not make as much money off of this idea had you got it invested in a sort of private sector space, but the impact that you have with the work that you're doing and the fact that we're asking you to open source your work has unimaginable possibilities. You have to trust us with that. And I think that when you think about, so for the example, the statistic of there being over 3 billion people without internet right now, you know, in this world, like for us, that's unbelievable. But when you really realize, that there's that many people in the world right now who don't have access to internet, therefore they don't have access to information, when you can bring new ideas and products and services to them, you know, from the baseline fiber optics to sort of these, you know, low bandwidth type of apps or tech products, you have a whole untouched space.
That example is a great way of answering my question. That yeah. There are certain kinds of projects, certain kinds of jobs that maybe are more appropriate for a business-oriented enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you know when you're doing good? You know, the world is kind of gray and ambiguous, and I'm just wondering how you deal with that, how you deal with the sense of knowing that you're making a difference for something that is good, and how you look at that.
That's hard. That's really hard to answer. I do know one sort of part of all of that. That knowing is simply like my own intuition. I think the other thing is it's a lot in retrospect. I look at a lot of the work that I've done, and I look at it 2 years after I've done it, 3 years after I've done it, or whatever, and I see that, you know, the hand that I had in it has a mark has been left. For example, you know, when I was a youth service coordinator for Little Tokyo Service Center, one of the things that I did was help coordinate a street basketball tournament for kids every year. And why we did that was because Little Tokyo had always wanted a recreation center built in the community, and it had never been achieved. And so as our sort of protest, in a way, we organized an outdoor street basketball tournament, and we would attract over 200 kids to this thing over the weekend. So I was, you know, organizing that tournament, advocating for this recreation center, and that was probably when, you know, a decade ago or so. And now I'm getting emails that we're investing in a recreation center, and we're fundraising. We actually have a building for it, and we have all these programs and services that we're going to be implementing. And to see that come into fruition, you're like, okay, I was on the right path then, and I knew it at the time, you know. And so it's a little bit of that proof later on, I think. And I think that's a kind of conundrum I have as a designer in general, is that design takes time, and results in a creative space often take time. And asking for someone to trust you and say, these results will come in a few years is the hardest thing to advocate for, because people want to know right away that you can prove that the thing that you're doing will show is showing results now, you know. And so I'm trying to kind of figure that out in general in the work that I do. But I think kind of going back to try to answer your question about how do I know that I'm doing the right thing is that I have to specify what I want to do. I think one of the big things is that I, for whatever reason, I really love advocating for youth. I think in a lot of the work that I do, it's always kind of been geared towards young people. So before I even went back to art school, it was always, you know, being a youth service coordinator or being a tutor or something like that, teaching young kids art and photography. And then UNICEF is all about children. Mm-hmm. And so I'm super passionate about that.
And do you know why? Is there a special way that you connect with youth, connect with young people in the world that touches you in a particular way that you would talk about?
I feel like since I was young, I used to like even, you know, help do, you know, I was like a leader at summer camp and did basketball coaching for young kids, all that stuff, since I was like in eighth grade, I think. But, I think what I really enjoy about working with youth is that, actually the vulnerability, because they're just trying to figure out what they want to do with themselves, mm-hmm. still, and mm-hmm. they want to find people that they can trust in to kind of disclose that they don't know what they're doing, you know. And I like being the person to be trusted in, you know. I really enjoy having people trust in me to help them, you know, in that sense, I guess, or to support them somehow. And so I naturally gravitate towards working with youth.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something so raw and open about working with them. It's not about breaking down like all these types of, you know, ideas that they have developed. It's about just fostering new ones to go on top of their curiosity. And I think that's what I really love about young people. Whereas working with adults, it's a lot about kind of breaking down
the kind blocks. Of barriers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. a lot about that. And like, sure, I can do that, you know, but I prefer the other way around of having more of like that sort of open kind of palette. And I personally feel like it helps just me be a better person because I can understand and learn and remain sensitive to people. And I think that's a huge value for a designer is to be able to remain sensitive.
And that's a sensitivity that you learn from kids, really.
Yeah. 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 And nice. So they remind nice. Me a lot, you know, they nice. Remind me a lot to stay that way. Mm. Yeah.
Is there something in your life that you were certain about and now you've changed your mind on and you look at it in a completely different way?
I don't know if I was ever certain about anything in my life. And I think I learned that early on because, you know, I lost my dad when I was just entering college. Hmm. And at that moment, I knew that, like, sort of that traditional family, mom, dad, and sibling kind of life wasn't going to happen for me, you know? And I think that was kind of maybe the first expectation I had about life in general was that you just kind of, you have your family to, and your parents die when they're old, and you have your career, and you get married, and you get a house, and all those sort of those steps, you know? And I think at a young age, I assumed that. And when I lost my father, I knew it's not going to be that way for me. So how am I going to survive? You know, how am I going to do this life thing? You know, and from then on, I started to really prepare and see that every choice that I was going to make wasn't necessarily going to lead to some expected end. And in design, in my career, to actually the choice to even be a designer and to go to Art Center was not planned. You know, I grew up just really focused in the traditional academic world, and design came quite late, I guess, you know, for me. And so that was not even expected. And even in my career now, I don't think if we go back to Art Center, I don't think I could have told you I would be where I am today. I really believe in uncertainty. Like, I'm okay with it. I'm really comfortable with it. Mm. I am very much a planner, and I'm a stickler for a lot of, you know, very
big organizer
things.
Too, I read.
Yeah. I'm there's that part of me that needs to be really organized and clean and, you know, straight lines and tight schedules and stuff like that. But then it's like this yin yang side of there's this total other side of me that's like, it's okay. You know, I can go with the flow and just, and I need that too to really balance me out.
I hadn't planned to ask this question, but you've sort of many things that you've said today intrigue me. And I have a personal fascination about the notion that we can know certain things only through making them. Mm-hmm. And that there are analytical ways of knowing and there are all kinds of ways of knowing, but making is one way of knowing. And it sounds to me, unless I'm projecting here a lot, and please be honest, that's relevant to you. That's pertinent to who you are as a designer, but also how you're living your life.
Yeah. You know, I know how to plan ahead, right? I can, that's why I can do my job, but I really believe in, you know, putting the bricks and mortar down to build your own path and direction too. And I think that you just don't know when you're going to come across a barrier in your life. And you know, you can plan ahead all you want, but you've got to be in the present as well as the future at the same time. If you want to do it, you know, and I think making things is like it reminds me of just like archaeologists discovering dinosaurs and, you know, rebuilding skeletons and things like that. You don't know what you're getting yourself into, but you spend all this time investing in piecing every bone together and you make this enormous skeleton, and then from there can rebuild and skin it and make a story around it, what it ate, who its predators were, you know, what happened to it, why it doesn't exist anymore. That type of energy is very much how I look at life too. And I think we have to trust ourselves a lot more as human beings and really be in touch with our intuition. I mean, that's what we used to, that's what people do all the time. Like, you know, if we didn't have weather apps and all these things, you know, like, what would we turn to? The sky, mm-hmm. maybe.
You have to stick your head out the window to find out if
exactly,
it's raining.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So people who are a lot more in touch with like nature and things like that, who have a better sense of their senses in general, those people can trust themselves a lot more for what they should and the choices that they make next, you know. And I think we need to really kind of make sure that as much as we're practicing all these new techniques and things to make beautiful and wonderful thing objects and products, we also have to like really kind of go back and understand how ourselves as human beings and like, you know, trust that intuition, be smart about it, of course, but really trust that's part of the sort of chemistry of who we are. And I think creative people tap into that really well. And that's why they are creative, because they're willing to be vulnerable and tap into that part and somehow really bring that back into the work that they're doing today.
So it's been several months since we spoke, and in the intervening time, you have a new position as Deputy Director of Design and Product with the New York City Mayor's Office, right?
Right. Since I've gotten on board, since we've kind of corrected that to the Deputy Director for the Service Design Studio.
What is the Service Design Studio?
So the Service Design Studio for New York City under the Mayor's Office of Economic Opportunity is the first municipal service design studio that's supporting low-income and middle-income New Yorkers. It's the nation's first. So we are a small team of designers who are sitting inside the government and really trying to infuse and bring service design to New York City government agencies so they can do a better job of, you know, deploying their projects and servicing New Yorkers.
Is there a way that you can describe in a minute or two? I understand this is our time is limited here, but can you describe for us some specific ways in which that is transpiring?
Sure. So I'm only about a little over 2 months in, so I'll try my best to describe what we're doing as much as possible. But for the Service Design Studio, well, for our whole design product team in general, we own two products. One is called Access NYC, which is a online benefits screener. So what that does is allow New Yorkers go online and basically figure out what type of city services and benefits they're eligible for. And that includes everything from, you know, discovering if you're eligible for food stamps to education services for your child to New York ID, those kind of things. And that allows like a New Yorker to really get an overview of things that they can access that they might normally not know that those services exist. Mm-hmm. Also, we're testing it out for people who are doing canvassing and going out in the fields, other service social workers and service providers who are working with the public to help use the platform to help them screen people that they're coming across when they're doing their social services. So that's one product. And the other one is a platform called Growing Up NYC, which is basically another digital space for parents, basically, currently in, actually has been for kids pre-K, or actually from birth to age 12, to just understand what type of services and events and resources are out there for their children. And we literally 2 days ago just launched a companion version called Generation NYC, which is more facing for a teen kind of young adult audience to give them access to events and trips and other types of mostly like mental health services, so they can get easy access to that. All these products were made using actually service design and design thinking tactics. So we didn't just build these just because we felt like they'd be good. We actually worked with youth and we worked with social workers, stakeholders in the government to build all of these things out properly. And, you know, even for the Generation NYC platform, interviewed over 100 youth to make sure we were getting the content that they really wanted to see in it. So those are two big products that basically we have ownership of. And then there's the Service Design Studio, which I'm the deputy for. And we literally just launched this studio publicly about 3 weeks ago. Along with a like tools and tactics toolkit, which is geared towards like supporting government agencies who are really trying to understand how might they infuse design thinking methodologies and practices into their work. How do they, you know, and because I think that's, and one of the things we're realizing is, you know, a lot of the government agencies, there's some amazing ideas out there, and but they just need a lot of support just trying to understand how do they talk to the stakeholders that are involved in their work, how do they empower them, how do they leverage them to just be part of the process as they build out an idea, whether it becomes a product or turns into something that helps push policy. So
very interesting. Yeah. Thank you. I just have one follow-up question, and that is, how do these services and products, how are they available? What do they look like? Are they websites? Are they interactive tools? Are they apps? How do you configure them? Yeah.
Sure. So Access NYC and Growing Up NYC, I can send you the websites, but those are actually website URLs. So you can go online and look at them right now if you like. And so those are two online platforms, and they're also mobile platforms as well. So those are digital. The Service Design Studio is the part that's like digital or paper-based, I guess, is the toolkit. So that's actually nyc.gov/service-design. If you enter through that website, you can get an overview of what the toolkit contains, and that will lead you to a webpage that has downloadable templates and kind of helps walk you through these different types of resources. And so that's available online.
Sounds from what you're describing that this echoes beautifully the kinds of principles and ideas and really passion that you were expressing in our conversation a few months ago about social innovation.
Yeah, I think, absolutely. I've been on this team for even a short period of time, already feel that like I am now really in an organization that has, from, you know, leadership on high, very invested in the value of design inside government agency, who really believes that you're not just an appendix or just a side, nice to have to help products and ideas be better, but that we're actually an integral part of the way we do our work, and that it's very necessary for us to be there. This is probably one of the first times I've ever really like been so in such a hugely supported environment like this.
And to what do we owe, in your estimation, this enlightened point of view?
I think, you know, for all the pioneers who have really pushed why design is good in the social space for so long now, it's starting to come, you know, come alive. I think, you know, me being someone who from over a decade ago had always been interested in thinking about how design can be used for social change, for social impact, for social justice. It had been a lot about trying to just prove our worth a lot of times. It had been a lot about saying, you know, we can make nice design for you if you'll let us in the door, and then, you know, trying to squeeze in further and show what else designers were capable of. And now I'm starting to feel like that bottleneck is starting to, you know, widen, and it's becoming a lot smoother for designers to be accepted in this space and also just valued for more than just, oh, you guys make beautiful things, but actually you guys have an amazing way of thinking about things, about organizing and simplifying, and also not forgetting that at the end of the day, the people that use the things that we're about to make. And at the end, it's so much more meaningful and everybody's so much more invested. And as a result, the products that we've had a hand in, they're more sustainable, you know?
Well, to you and all the pioneers that come before you carrying the flag, it's great to see this come to fruition and that this day has arrived. It's exciting and it's exciting because ultimately it's very meaningful to people's lives.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Change Lab. The best way to support the show is to share it with your community. And please feel free to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes, Google Play, or the Apple Podcasts app. For a deeper dive into the astonishing creativity and innovation coming out of Art Center, please visit our website at artcenter.edu. Thanks for listening.